You're listening to C2Y Podcast. We bring you discussions on child and youth care that feature conversations with young people, parents, and professionals about the youth social service system. Introducing your host, Wolfgang Vachon.
Welcome to C2Y Podcast, discussions on child and youth care. This is episode number 48, and I'm your host, Wolfgang Vachon. As I mentioned in the last podcast, we're going to be changing our name to CYC Podcast starting in April. Hopefully, you'll be able to find us from either URL, CYC Podcast or C2Y Podcast. I'm still working out some of the technical obstacles with that. Today, we're going to be talking about boundaries in residential care. I know that every day I work with young people and their families, I need to make decisions about boundaries. When is it okay to physically touch a child? When is it negligent not to? I have phone numbers of young people I work with in my cell phone, and they have mine. When does treating people equitably mean treating people differently and not being consistent in all situations? Gifts, contact with people who have left programs, sharing personal information and stories, connecting over social media are all questions that workers need to make decisions about. They are also all topics that Phil Cody has been exploring through his research into boundaries as they are actually practiced in residential care in Scotland. I'd like to welcome Phil. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, thank you.
I want to start by asking, what led you to do this research on boundaries?
Well, there are three parts to that. The middle part is that I work in a small county called East Lothian, just outside Edinburgh in Scotland. And in a residential service over the last 20 years, something had evolved relating to boundaries. We had been fairly conscious about what we did, but it evolved over a significant period of time, which led me to believe, and led us to believe, that there was something different about the way we used relationship boundaries than the way that other places in Scotland were doing that.
So in your particular workplace, something had evolved?
Yes, and it had evolved from, it had been a bottom-up thing, really, that had come from us within the residential home, but at the same time, it was also importantly supported by senior managers in the organisation, and I think both of those aspects were important. From my own personal point of view, and I was just one of a kind of core group of people who was interested in things evolving in this way. My first experience of residential care was that I worked initially as a volunteer in a community, and that community was, it was like a residential school, but we all lived there and we worked there with the young people on the basis that we were there, you know, more or less all the time, very long hours. But inevitably that had a real impact on the kind of relationships that developed between workers and young people, and then the kind of boundaries that it made sense to have, because when you live and work in the same place and when you spend huge amounts of time with people, that changes the nature of the relationship, which in turn changes the boundaries that feel appropriate for that relationship. And the third aspect of that was I'm involved in another bit of research at the moment with young people who we looked after in the year 2000, who are all round about their 30th birthday at the moment. And I was really struck in those interviews that I was doing by how often young people mention things about the family members of workers, or going away with a worker and somebody else in their family, or doing other things that would in most other places not be something that people would be comfortable with. And so the idea of looking into relationship boundaries a bit more, and alongside that of being able to do something that compared our organisation with other organisations became really interesting. And so when an opportunity came up to do a research project, that very quickly came into my mind as the project that I wanted to do.
I want to jump to the third of those three things just for a moment. So these people that you're currently interviewing or involved in research with, they were from your agency, or they were from care in general in that community?
No, they all lived in the same house at the same time, and we looked after them.
Okay.
15 years ago.
Okay, okay.
And we still have some kind of connection with all of them, some regularly, some not so regularly, but that connection is still there. Right. And there are a few reasons why that has been able to evolve as well, I think, but it certainly is there. And we have connections with people who we've looked after for several years and sometimes more like decades afterwards. Mm.
You say you work in a smaller community, and of course, yes. You know, I live in a large city with, you know, 2 million plus people in it, and it's completely possible for me to spend years and years and years and years and never see people that I've worked with. I'm assuming that that is not possible for you.
Probably not easily possible never to see them, but I suppose the point for us is that the contact is planned contact. It's not that we accidentally bump into people, it's that we put things in place to make sure that we have that contact.
So you are intentionally maintaining contact with people after they officially leave your programs?
Yes, and for potentially very long periods of time, kind of in the same way that as would happen in a family or in a foster family, that we don't think that because we've placed young people in a residential placement that those needs that children have suddenly disappeared for them. We think they still have those needs and that we need to find an appropriate way of meeting them.
So you're challenging everything I teach right now, Phil. because what I teach is, you know, okay, when people terminate,
yeah,
as, you know, we like to, you know, such a pleasant term that we use, when people leave our programs, we should not maintain contact with them.
Yeah.
And yes, that, you know, they need to, you know, separate, and the young people need to move on with their lives and not foster a dependence upon, yep, the worker. And yes, the worker, you know, doesn't have the resources and time to manage people that span decades. Why are you doing something different?
There are a few reasons for that. One reason is we are trying to start, rather than thinking about what is the worker's role as our first question, we're trying to make our first question, what does the young person need? And although you would think that whichever question you start with, you should maybe come up with the same answer, we don't really find that that's what happens. We find that if you start with the question, what is the worker's role, you do end up with these kind of rules that define our professionalism by saying, at the end of the period of service, the relationship ends, because those are the kind of rules that more established professions have, and we kind of seem to have, well, I would say fallen into them a bit. I mean, I know other people might think we've put more thought into it than that. But for me, if you start with what does a young person need, I think it becomes very difficult to say that if we wouldn't talk about a child continuing to have contact with their family as being fostering dependence, or if we wouldn't choose to talk about a child who we've put into family foster care continuing to have that contact as dependence. Why do we talk about it as dependence? Because we've placed somebody in residential care. And why do they need something less afterwards?
Absolutely. I would be absolutely heartbroken if I could not maintain a relationship with my parents.
Yeah.
Or my sister, who yes, you know, I lived with. What are you finding from this longitudinal study that you're part of? And I know that this is, you know, you're part of, and you haven't published on it.
Yes. I've not completed it yet, but yes, but I've done almost all of the interviews. And the main things for me that won't be surprising to most people, one of them is when you look at what the young people. And for each young person, there is also a worker who the young person chooses a worker for me to interview about them as well. And one of the main things is the degree to which people talk about the relationship, and usually a particularly special or significant relationship, as being the main thing which caused change to happen. So, you know, rather than people saying, whenever I did this, I got this consistent response, and so I learned to change, people will say things like, I had a particularly good relationship. So, you know, I'll maybe talk about a few young people and workers. So, I'll use pseudonyms for any young people and workers that I speak about.
Great.
So, for example, a young person called Karen had kind of said to me, well, I had a really good relationship with Sylvia, and so first I didn't trust any adults, and then I learned to trust Sylvia, and then once I trusted her, I thought I could probably trust other workers, and then after that I thought maybe there's other adults that I can trust as well. And so she was really describing a theory of change or a process of change that she felt she had gone through, and it was a process that was mediated by a relationship that became significant enough to change her whole view of the adult world and also of what she could expect from other people and about what people, how people viewed her.
And that relationship, would you say that the awareness and the transformation happened after she left the home?
Well, there were kind of stages to it, and this is a bit of a problem, I suppose, because obviously we quite like to measure things. So the problem that you have, I guess, is that if I use something which is maybe a quicker way of trying to change somebody's behaviour, a more behavioural method of some kind of consistent reinforcement, it's likely that I'll be able to remember measure the results of that fairly quickly. But for a process like this, you know, the way that Melvin Rose describes this process is that there's sometimes a period of latency. And so the results of that kind of process don't appear immediately or as quickly as they would by a more behavioural method, but they're likely to be sustained for longer because they involve a different kind of change. They involve a change in your worldview rather than just an adaptation in your behaviour in order to achieve reward. So we found that it happened in stages, and it was difficult for the team because at the beginning of those stages, that meant that Sylvia was treated really well and had a really nice relationship, and the rest of us were all treated fairly horribly. and it was really important that as a team that we avoided the temptation to ask Sylvia to punish the person on our behalf. We needed to accept that this was part of a process, and that if we could stick with it, that in time the ability to expand that network of trust would take its course. And that's exactly what happened. And certainly even during the course of the placement, you know, by the end of that placement, and I've seen this process happen quite a number of times, the, you know, relationships with the whole team had really developed in a positive way.
So what you're arguing here and what you're exemplifying here is a relational approach over a behavioralist approach. And what you're claiming is that while more difficult to measure and well, much, much, much longer, ultimately, that approach is going to be more effective. Do I have you correct so far?
Yes, and to last longer. And certainly for me, for the young person to be talking about that in that way 15 years later, to me, gave quite a good indication that certainly that was their understanding of what had happened. You know, and because the workers involved were talking about it in a similar way, that was interesting as well. And it did feel as though those things were consistently there in a few of the interviews. You know, but almost all of the interviews, you could pick out things like that described a process of that kind. And in fact, in these interviews, and these were all people who lived in the same place at the same time, everybody was able to talk about one adult who they considered to be somebody that they had an especially significant relationship with.
And were these different adults?
They were. There was some overlap, and it's not that each young person only had one person, but yeah, there was quite a range of different people mentioned that had worked with young people. as somebody that had a special relationship. And most of those things had happened fairly organically, although there are also times where we sometimes think about that more consciously and think, you know, a really significant relationship isn't developing organically for this person, so let's try a more conscious approach and think about how we could make sure that we offer that to this person because we think everybody needs to have that.
And what would that look like? So thinking as a relational practitioner, yeah, if I want to create a stronger relationship when it's not happening organically, how might I go about doing that?
Well, I suppose different places might do it differently. For us, one of the things that we would focus on in that situation, I suppose, is arranging time for a worker to spend one-to-one with a young person and to try and create that opportunity for that sense of a special relationship to come across to the young person. Although I must admit, to come back to kind of relationship boundary crossing behaviour and so on, one of the most effective ways that I have found to do that is for there to be some elements of boundary crossing in the relationship, because the messages that can be contained in boundary crossing are so powerful that sometimes it is impossible to get that sense of a significant relationship across anywhere near as strongly without doing that.
And so what do you mean by boundary crossing in this context?
Well, I suppose the first thing to say is, I think Carol Stewart has a really great bit of writing in her chapter about boundaries in Standing on the Precipice, and she talks about the way in which flexible boundary behaviour is often described in negative terms, like violating boundaries or blurring boundaries, and inflexible boundary behaviour is often talked about in positive terms, like, you know, this person has very clear boundaries. So it feels as though the language that we use already shows us that we have a preference for the idea of boundaries being fairly fixed. So, you know, she suggests that a more neutral or even positive language for flexibility in boundaries, like boundary crossing, would be a useful thing, because it takes us out of that situation where we always have this bias towards boundaries being more fixed and being the same for everybody, and lets us go into a place where we think more about how we can use boundaries consciously and flexibly to help to meet the aims of the work that we're trying to do. Because there, you know, it certainly has been argued often, and I think it comes across in Carol Alexander and Grant Charles' work, that the boundaries that we have don't always support the theories that we espouse or the ways of working that we say that we want to use. So from our point of view, we want the boundaries to match the way that we are trying to work.
Which is, what is the young person's need?
Yeah, that's really the first question that we have to ask. What does the young person need, and how can I safely meet that need in a way that will be most helpful to the young person?
And so how does one safely cross boundaries?
Well, there are a number of different ways of doing that, and it is difficult to define boundary crossing behaviour. When I was working out my questions, it was sometimes quite difficult to work out what areas should I include as boundary crossing. You know, there'd be some things that a worker might do that some people would be considered to be boundary crossing, and other people might not. And maybe the most straightforward of them is touch or physical contact. I mean, I certainly think, well, we have to include that as boundary crossing behaviour, in the sense that you are making a physical contact with somebody, and, you know, one of our boundaries, I guess, is our kind of personal space and our body, and, you know, it's something that we don't want to do without any thought or without any regard for how that will come across to the other person, or how that will meet the needs of the other person or of our relationship with them. In all of those things, for me, there is something about the way that the place that we are working facilitates our ability to do those things in a helpful way for the young person. So for us, that might mean things like having community events or trips where people may be invited in, including family members of workers, and of course family members of young people as well. So the normal situation of just having the workers and the young people around might change for periods of time like that. We might also have times where, you know, we work a shift system, which doesn't always work very well. Important things are happening in the lives of young people at times we're not meant to be around, so we would maybe have flexibility about people being able to be around at important times for the young person, or to spend extra time with the young person outside of their normal shift times, to have other ways of contacting young people, which might include, for example, text messages and things like that, and that might happen outside of work time. So there are a lot of things that we might do that would give a young person a message about the significance of our relationship, because we might, you know, I might only be doing this with one person, and so that gives that person a message about there is something particularly significant about our relationship, because there are different things that happen in our relationship than in my relationship with other people in the group.
So what happens with other people in the group who may be witnessing this relationship and they say, oh, Phil has this really wonderful relationship with Wolfgang, and, you know, Phil doesn't text me, and Phil doesn't hang out with me. How does the workspace negotiate that?
Yeah, I think we're quite scared of it in general. And, you know, I'll kind of come back in a wee while to what are the safety elements that are put in place that we believe make those things safe. But to start off with your question about how does another young person view that, I think what our fear is that will be interpreted as, you know, that there is favoritism, or that, you know, one person is jealous of relationships with another person, or these things. And I suppose all of these things are possible, and that's why we're scared, because we'll need to work out what to do about them if they happen. So I think we started from a position where we thought, well, the importance of this is so great that we need to find a way of making it work. We can't carry on having a sterile environment where there is a lowest common denominator, where everything that Phil does for this young person, he has to do for every other young person, and so on, because inevitably that leads you to that lowest common denominator, because sometimes it's not just not possible for one person to do all of those things for everybody in the group, and not everybody in the group would want those things anyway. So in practice, what we found out was the important thing isn't for every individual worker to treat every young person in exactly the same way, and to try to pretend that some relationships become more significant than others. It is to try and make sure that every young person has the opportunity to have that experience with somebody. And at times that might mean that I have that with two young people and somebody else doesn't have it with any young people at the moment, but maybe next year they'll have that with two young people and I won't. We need to be responsive to the cues of the young people about who they want to have a significant relationship with. And that means that even though we might have appointed a key worker at the beginning, we might have to either rethink that or add another person in, because we recognise that that important relationship has evolved, and we want to acknowledge it and make the best use of it that we can.
And safety?
Well, obviously, the safest thing would be not to allow any of these things to happen, in terms of avoiding any incident of that kind of flexibility being abused. But then the safest way of avoiding reoffending for people who've committed offences is capital punishment, but that doesn't mean that we support it. We can find other ways of managing any risks that we think come about as a result of being more flexible. And so for us, the two main tools that we think that we have to help us do that are transparency and what we think about as the safety of the team. So transparency would mean, for example, if I have a significant relationship with a young person and maybe to take it to its, you know, take it to a fairly significant level, there have been occasions where I've had relationships with young people. One young person comes to mind whose father, for a period of time, his father was in prison and his mother was in a psychiatric hospital. He was locked in a secure unit and would have been allowed to have some contact outside with his family if they had been able to offer it, but of course they weren't able to. So I offered to do that on behalf of his family while they were unable to do it, and that meant that my home address became the place where his time out of the secure unit would happen, which is quite a significant boundary crossing, maybe as significant as you could have. But the transparent bit of that for me was that I had spoken to his family about that, and they were keen for this to happen and very appreciative of the fact that I could offer this at a time when they weren't able to do that. Obviously, the senior managers in my organisation were aware of it. The secure unit where he was living was aware of it. The children's hearing system, which in Scotland is the replacement for the court, the legal mechanism by which these things happen, was aware of it too. So it was important to us that if we were offering to do things of this kind that were a significant boundary crossing, that you are happy to do that in a way that involves a level of transparency that you would be very unlikely to want to, or and a level of attention that you would be very unlikely to want to bring to yourself if your motives were, you know, to have clandestine contact with a young person. We also try to use the team in a way that means that we don't think of any of these things that we do, whether they are something of that kind or giving a gift to a young person or anything that we might do as an individual, whether it's in work time or not, whether it's in the place of work or not, is part of the work of the team. So, for example, when I wanted to make this offer, the first thing that I had to do, although I was the manager as well, was to go to the team meeting and say, I want to make this offer. And it was up to the team to decide, is that an offer that's in the best interest of the young person? Do we feel that this is a safe arrangement? Are there any things that we're worried about that we would want to put in place to limit that or to make it safe? And so those things are team decisions. And, you know, I suppose another issue about transparency, whenever these things were happening, even though they might be happening in my home and in my own time, they were recorded in the home's diary, and the visits were recorded by me as well. So the thing was seen as part of the work of the organisation and something that I was doing on behalf of the organisation, not something that I was doing as an individual.
And let's suppose you and I are working in the same place and I'm not comfortable having somebody, you know, offering this the same level.
Yeah.
What does... Do you terminate me?
Absolutely not. No, we have a range. I mean, one of the things about the relationship boundaries questionnaire that we did was that we did it within our own organisation, and we did one outside of our organisation where people from 40 other organisations in different parts of Scotland responded to that. And within our own organisation, and this wasn't a surprise to us, there was a big range of levels of flexibility, and there were some people who were significantly less flexible. The survey was made up of questions, for example, about having physical contact with young people, about giving gifts, about young people having contact with members of our family, about contact by social media or by mobile technology. For every question, people answered either that they would do this, never, occasionally, frequently, or routinely. And just as a measure of overall flexibility, I used a scoring system to work of 0 for never, 1 for occasionally, 2 for frequently, and 3 for routinely. So overall, the responses that we got overall, the lowest score was 0. There was one person who said never to every single question. And the highest score was 36, which meant that there were quite a lot of frequentlies and occasionallys in that, and very few nevers. But within our own organisation, the range that we had was 12 was the lowest score and 36 was the highest. So significant differences there, and yet we've never found that to cause a major problem. And what seems to happen, it's a combination of two things. You know, culture does play a part in the way that people's relationship boundary beliefs appear to develop, because in our organisation we had nobody with a score lower than 12, whereas in the rest of Scotland nearly a third of the scores were scores of less than 10, you know, scores of 0 to 9. So definitely our culture did appear to play a part in increasing people's scores, but nevertheless there was variation from 12 to 36. So and Keris Garabagi writes a bit in Professional Issues in Child and Youth Care about this, and it is about that, you know, people's personal opinions and beliefs about relationship boundary issues can be quite resistant to change. And although I think some change has happened for our workers, leading to them having higher scores, there are definitely some people who just have a less flexible or a more flexible mindset about these things. But for us, it doesn't feel that it has caused significant problems. It does seem to be it seems to be possible for people to work alongside each other, and for us to find ways of managing things that make that workable for everybody. One of those things, for example, is we usually on a young person's birthday we'll try and go out in the evening for a meal, and lots of people will come who are not working, but quite often we'll try to have that a time where people who might be less likely or less able to come outside of the working time, we'll try to have it at a time when they can be around and are on shift, and where people who are more likely and more able to come at times when they're not working, they will come anyway, so we'll be less likely to try to arrange it during their shift time. So there are things that we can do to try and make the most of what everybody is able to offer. And we're also aware that at different times in people's lives, they have different levels of flexibility and different other responsibilities to attend to as well.
Phil, we started off this conversation about boundaries, and really what I think you've so eloquently done is have a conversation about how to effectively implement relational practice in a residential setting, which puts the needs of young people first and foremost in a way that honors and respects and supports staff. And I want to commend, you know, you and the organization that you're working with for giving us a model of that. And I'm really looking forward to reading the rest of your research. I know you're doing research on, you know, perceptions of young people and the longitudinal study. Yeah. And I'm really, really looking forward to reading more. And hopefully it'll be widely disseminated, because I think that what you're providing is a map for us in how to live relational practice in a way that is realizable. So thank you for the work, and thank you very, very much for taking the time to do this interview with me today.
Thank you.
This concludes this month's episode of C2Y Podcast. Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher, and visit us at c2ypodcast.org.